So good to be with you on this day. Would you pray with me? Oh Lord, whenever you call women and men to preach, you run the risk of putting treasure in earthen vessels, clay pots that are liable to be cracked. And so I pray this morning, as we are all gathered here together, that I might decrease so that you might increase. Hide me behind your cross, that the words of our mouths and the meditation of our hearts might be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our rock and our redeemer. Amen. It seems to me, listening to Job this morning, that Job has a lot of things, a lot going on in his life. But the one thing he doesn't seem to have is what we often call the patience of Job. Job's been going through, you know the story. If you hear this early on a Sunday morning, you know the story. He lost his home. He lost his livelihood. He lost his loved ones. This brother has lost everything, and on top of it all, he's aching and moaning with sores on his body. Job has lost everything, and all he has left is these lousy friends who come to him with all sorts of God talk, all sorts of explanations or questions. You know how people ask you questions when you're going through? Questions that beg some kind of answer that maybe they're suggesting or maybe they're hoping that you will discover, and none of it is any help at all. Job's lost everything. And if Job has anything, by the time we get here to the 23rd chapter, Job's got the blues. I was listening to him this week as I was reading this passage. I was listening to him like he was sitting on a front porch somewhere down in the Mississippi Delta. My complaint is bitter. Got this heavy load on my back. Can you hear it? Oh, my complaint is bitter. Got this heavy load on my back. I need somebody to hear me, but I ain't got Jack. Da-na-na-na-na. Job has the blues. And I don't know if you feel it with him, but I thought, since I was going to be with you all today, that I'd let you know, I talk to lots of folks these days who've got the blues. Their complaint is bitter, carrying a heavy load on their back, and they need somebody to help them, but it seems like they just ain't got Jack. 2 weeks ago, I was on Capitol Hill. The day before Christine Blasey Ford was there to testify, I was there with Sandra Marquina from here in Raleigh. Sandra's husband, Jose, came into sanctuary with us over in Durham 15 months ago. He came to North Carolina from El Salvador 33 years ago and has lived here ever since. He married Sandra here. They raised their kids here. They have a home in Raleigh, and he pastors a church in Raleigh. When he went to his first appointment with ICE, the government agency that manages immigration issues, when he went for his first appointment after the Trump administration began, they told him, after 32 years of living in the United States, that he needed to make plans to leave. They would give him 3 months to sell his home, to say goodbye to his church and family. He had to leave without any hope of ever coming back. He wasn't sure what he was going to do, But his son, who was just finishing elementary school, his son went to a rally over at the State House and told the story. The thing I remember most as he was crying is he said, I'm supposed to graduate from elementary school this year, and my dad is being deported the day before I graduate. But we talked about it and prayed about it and learned that sanctuary might be a way for him to be able to stay, and so he came into sanctuary with us, and we were on Capitol Hill, and Sandra was sharing the story of how this zero tolerance policy has ripped their family apart. It's not just what's happening down there on the border when folks are coming across, but families that have been here for decades are being torn apart. You know the story. Maybe some of you know about Rosa, who's right here in Chapel Hill. Rosa, who's been at Reconciliation. But in almost all of our communities, people are being ripped apart. And what I heard Sandra saying to the members of Congress there on the Hill, Congressman David Price was sitting in the room. He was on the dais there in the committee room as she was telling the story. She was saying, my complaint is bitter. I've got this heavy load on my back. My husband, who used to work and provide for our family while I was also working and providing for our family, we don't have his income anymore. And in addition to not having his income and trying to make it without that, I'm also having to drive over to Durham to try to stay in touch with my husband. And our kids have been going through. One of them had a mental health crisis in the midst of this. And I've got this heavy load on my back. And I know that we're right. I know the justice of our cause, but I can't get anyone to hear me. I had gone with her to the White House earlier this year, and we stood outside. And she sounded like Job. I looked to the east, I looked to the west, I looked to the north and the south, and there's no one to hear me. Who will answer the just cause of so many who are suffering? So many of us have the blues. I was talking just this week with a dear young woman who I met back when, do you remember the Dream Act? When the Dream Act was in Congress, and there were these incredibly hopeful young people who had come here as children to this country. And I met this young woman, Claudia. Claudia kind of became politicized through that movement. She, you know, she had been in college. She had learned a little bit, but she learned how the political process works by advocating on the Hill and in other places for this Dream Act, and they almost thought they were going to get it. Do you remember that December when it was almost going to pass the Senate and it failed, and it was just crushing to so many of those people who had some hope that they had a future here, and yet in the midst of that crushing defeat, they regathered and realized that they had been advocating for a solution that would have created a future for them without their parents. And they were kind of radicalized by that. And they realized that their dream had been too small. That as a matter of fact, they needed to imagine a bigger and a broader future, not only for them, but for this country, that they needed to imagine that another America was possible. And they began to teach people that, and they began to advocate in communities and to do direct actions that have kind of awakened communities to do what the sanctuary movement is doing today, to come around people and to say, we want to imagine a different future for our community that includes all of our neighbors. I was sitting in talking to Claudia just this week, and I had been reading Job, and I was listening to her as she reflected on how she's been in this struggle for a while now, and she told me, I know how to do this work, I know that I'm good at it, but I'm just so tired, I don't know when this is going to change. I don't even know who we can appeal to get this to change. Sandra's there, Claudia's there, Job was there. I suspect some of you are there. I don't know what angle you're coming from, but a lot of the people I talk to these days know that they're working for something that is just, for something that is right, and yet they're not sure who they can appeal to. They can't imagine who could act, who could make a difference. Job's got the blues and invites us, I think, to understand in this passage the hope that is in the blues notes. A hope that, first of all, directs our appeal, directs our cry to God. It's too easy sometimes. I think it's too easy for us to think that if we could just get those folks who are over in Raleigh out of power, or if we could just get that person who's in the White House, if we could just replace him, or if we could just check him in these midterms with some people who would exercise some balance from the Congress, if we could just change the balance of power a little bit, there would be a difference. Oh, it would make a difference. All of that would make a difference for sure. And yet, the blues teach us that somewhere deep in our human struggle, somewhere we have to recognize that our ultimate complaint has to go all the way to God, all the way to whoever it is that allows all this to happen. People are selfish. I don't care what party they're part of. Selfish people will do selfish things when they're in power. And selfish people need to be checked. Their power needs to be checked. That happens in the political sphere. It has to happen here in church politics too. Y'all know that story here better than I do, but I know it in other places. At any rate, it happens anywhere people get together. Our egos and our selfishness has to be checked. And yet, ultimately, underneath all of that, there is this question of, when will God act? When will God do something? That's what Job is asking. Job is saying, I don't have anybody to blame for this but God. I want to make my appeal directly to God. In the blues, there is this aching, this longing to understand why God makes a world where this is possible. Why does God allow it to go on? The philosophers have called it the problem of evil, but that's too philosophical for what Job is going through. Job says, I'm carrying it on my back. This pain is in my body. I can't get away from it. This is real. Job has what we call skin in the game. And I hear him singing that song when Aretha Franklin crossed on over. This was the one that stuck most with me. I don't know if you've ever heard her sing it. If you haven't, my deep love in the church is for the church's music. So go home and YouTube this one. She sings with Joe Legan. She sings, I've been in the storm too long. You know the song? That's all the song is. I've been in the storm. I've been in the storm. I've been in the storm too long, and I need a little time to pray. They sing that for 4 or 5 minutes. And they sing it with all of the longing and the pain and the real feeling of the blues notes that Job is striking, that I've heard Sandra and Claudia and so many people striking in these recent weeks. The truth of those blues notes that say, I know the justice of my cause and I want to take it all the way to the top. I want to appeal directly to God. I've been in the storm too long and I need a little time. I need a little time to pray. And as they sing it, and sing it and face the truth in that song, it turns into an invitation. She literally ends the song by saying, the doors of the church are open. Come on to Jesus. The longing of the blues notes direct us toward a God who is going to hear our cause, because if this God is just, we know that this God has to stand with us in the end. And Aretha Franklin's singing of that blues chord, of that blues truth, leads to an invitation. Ultimately, I think the hope of the blues notes is that it points us first to God, but also that it points us to the fact that the willingness to face the reality, the willingness to face the pain of what's real in the world around us, is part and parcel of what makes change possible in this world. I think that's the other thing that's deep here in this. It's a condition of truth to let suffering speak. And when suffering speaks, when the people who carry the load on their back are able to speak and to speak out honestly, when we are empowered to speak our truth, not to cover it up, not to push it under the rug, not to try to make it look pretty on Sunday morning because that's what church is supposed to be. No, when Job invites us to cry out, to sing those blues notes, we're invited to become part of that movement that is built of suffering people who find hope in a God who meets us in our suffering and who build connections with others, which is the only thing that has ever changed this world. I was thinking over the last couple weeks, as we've wrestled with the takeover of the Supreme Court by the Federalist Society, which has been a long time coming, but is most recently manifest in the tipping of the balance by this new Justice Kavanaugh. I was thinking about the 19th century and how old Andrew Jackson, you remember Andrew Jackson, a hero to our current president, but a slave-holding brother who was a hard-nosed man. He was in charge of overseeing the whole Trail of Tears that drove Native folks off their lands around here to the west in Oklahoma. So many died on that Trail of Tears. But another part of Jackson's legacy that lasted much longer than his presidency was his appointment of Roger Taney to the Supreme Court. And it was Taney who in 1857 wrote the decision in the Dred Scott case, which was really a strong blues note in the abolitionist struggle, which by that point had been a large public movement for 25 years. They had been building momentum for abolition in this country, for the recognition that it was a moral issue, that people were holding other people in bondage, and that folks had to stand up and do something about this. This had caused political turmoil. This had rent the churches into so many of the denominations split over this issue in the 1840s and the 1850s. But 1857. Felt like a death blow to the movement, because the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States wrote in his opinion that there was no right that a black man had that a white man was obliged to respect. And that was the law of the land. And that was the precedent by which all other courts were to make their decision. And in response to that, Frederick Douglass gave a little talk. Frederick Douglass, who had been in the abolitionist movement the whole time, who had himself been enslaved and had escaped to freedom, and after escaping to freedom had been an organizer and a preacher in that abolition movement that had been building to challenge the immorality of this system. Frederick Douglass said, "In one point of view, we, the abolitionists and colored people, should meet this decision, unlooked for and monstrous as it appears, in a cheerful spirit." In a cheerful spirit, he said, "This very attempt to blot out forever the hopes of an enslaved people may be one necessary link in the chain of events preparatory to the downfall and complete overthrow of the whole slave system." That's the blues notes. That's playing on that blues note. "The whole history of the anti-slavery movement is studded with proof that all measures devised and executed with a view to ally and diminish the anti-slavery agitation have only served to increase, intensify, and embolden that agitation." Frederick Douglass said, "This might look bad. Oh, this might look bad. But I'm a member of a people who know that the blues notes teach us that everything that's put against us only serves to make our determination stronger. That somehow, in paying attention to the truth of what's really happening and opening ourselves to the pain and the reality of the suffering in our world, we can also open ourselves to the God who meets us in that suffering and gives us an unimaginable determination to press on. To press on, to reach out, to connect with others who are suffering, to join with them in this struggle, and to say, maybe even the worst thing we could imagine is but a necessary step toward the agitation that will make the world that we know is true and good and real possible. May it be. May it be. And come, Lord Jesus, may it be as soon as possible. Amen.